Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of the Accessibility Edition of the Coworking Values Podcast. I'm Emily Breeder, and I facilitate work in challenging circumstances. Today, I have with me Janine van der Linden from the European Coworking Assembly. Janine, I understand you're one of the authors of the ECA IDEA Handbook, which stands for Inclusion, Diversity, Equity, and Accessibility. Is that correct?
I think I'm not one of the authors. I was the doula bringing it into being.
I think it counts.
Yeah, I guess so. Because it was a massive project. It was a project of many, many years, and many, many people contributed to it. And my primary goal was to keep it going. So I wrote the introduction to the book, but the book itself is written by a team of people who have both training and lived experience in inclusion, diversity, equity, and accessibility. And I felt like those were the right places to write that book.
And what was the goal or the object behind writing the handbook?
The assembly did a pre-pandemic, I think it's like 2 years pre-pandemic, I guess. We did a sort of listening tour right across the UK and Europe, going to co-working spaces and having gatherings of people who run co-working spaces to talk to them about inclusion, diversity, equity, and accessibility. Where were they on it? And what was their interest and all of that stuff. And what we heard back over and over was that this happens a lot in this area. The people who come to your gatherings, the people who come to your meetups, the people who come to events about this are already on board in terms of the sort of principle of the thing. And everyone was interested not in the why, in the how. So we were getting questions about, for instance, how can I go about making my space accessible for people with disabilities? How can I go about making my space welcoming for people in the LGBTQ plus community? How can I do something? This project started in many ways with a Facebook conversation between me and Ramon Suarez in Brussels, because he was commenting about the extreme tilt towards men in his co-working space and young men around his own age. And I said, well, Ramon, there's this thing we call it founder bias, because my space is predominantly women over 45. Not hugely predominantly, but there's a definite skew there. And that's because when they come in the door, I'm who's there. And the choices that I am making, when I am making the choices, often my coworkers make the choices, that's different. But when I am making the choices, I am making choices similar to the choices they would make. And so obviously, so it appeals to them. And that conversation started this whole sort of project rolling, because that happens in a very sort of unconscious way. And if you can make your choices in a mindful way, you can actually change that skew. It's actually not that you're some kind of powerful hero standing at the door of your co-working space. it's just the things you speak of in your social media, the things you decide about what to do in your space. How many monitors do you have? What do you have on the floor? Do you have curtains or blinds? Right? All of those things speak to a particular aesthetic. They speak to a particular approach. That approach speaks to some people and not others. If, like me, you started your space very much by yourself with a very small community, then you make those choices to suit yourself and the coworkers you have. And that is not a terribly mindful way to go about making those choices, but it is how people in practice have done it. And so after the listening tour, one of the things that we brought to the book was people really want to know how. to make those decisions in a mindful way. I am not a guy, and I am not 30 years old, and I don't actually have a great deal of insight into what would be particularly attractive to people in that particular demographic, right? Mm-hmm. So I have to go find me one and ask, right? And the one that I would find, you know, maybe would be typical and maybe would not.
Right.
There's a methodology, there's a way of going about this, which, of course, we didn't encounter when you're sort of setting up your own business in the way that most independent community-based co-working spaces start. It's pretty much bootstrapping, and it's pretty much the entrepreneur making choices. That's what
right.
So fundamentally, what the handbook is, was the culmination of many years after that listening tour of sort of examining how, what kind of structure. So it is a workbook. It is a very practical book. It has blank places for you to fill in, right? It has questions to answer. And it helps people who are running independent community-based co-working spaces to be mindful about the choices they're making. It's not so about what it's not about is what choices you should make, because that's
right.
your job, right? That's not my job. It is an effort to bring mindfulness to that.
Do you think that so it sounds like you're describing that part of the workbook is sort of breaking through your own invisible kind of confirmation bias about the way things should work should be the way I work.
Oh yeah. I mean, if you have by the time we were writing this book, I had already been running. I have a network of co-working spaces in the Netherlands. We have 9 locations right now. And in my own space, we had already, after I had this realization, like, oh, look what I did when I was talking to Ramon. We went through sort of a change process with the community itself about, I don't think my co-workers would have called it a change process, but it was. About who are we missing? Who are we leaving out? Who are we leaving behind? And if you do that in a structured way instead of an intuitive way, which I had to have a structure because I'm a very intuitive person, so then you see whole chunks of things that you weren't seeing before, that you didn't realize before.
What's an example of some of the things that have come out of it since then? Like, how has, since the listing tour, how have things changed?
The way people talk about the issues around inclusion, diversity, equity, and accessibility has changed a lot, and it changed very quickly. And it's one of the things that people are always talking about, like, oh, yesterday we could use this word, and now we're not allowed to use that word because it's a bad word. And it's silly, because the reason language changes because people are having conversations, and people are learning things, and their way of looking at the world becomes broader. And so, of course, your language changes because you have whole new chunks of concepts in your head now that you have to express with that word, so you can't use the other word. And I think that's one of the things that has happened. Of course, the pandemic had... one of the things that the specifically focusing in on the accessibility community, one of the things that people with disabilities have been hollering about for a very long time is the need for remote access, remote work. We have hybrid, what we now call hybrid options. And it took the pandemic to bring them. And that was interesting. And it was upsetting for a lot of people because basically we've been yelling for years, of course it's possible, right? And everybody's like, yeah. No, it's impossible. You have to come to the office, right? And then suddenly no one could go to the office. And then all at once, it's completely and totally possible, right? Like, it was always completely and totally possible.
Right.
It was a question of having the will to do it. And one of the conversations that's happening right now, of course, is that quite a lot of organizations are like, okay, pandemic over, now we're going back, and it's not possible anymore.
Right. You can't walk backwards in some cases like this. Yeah.
Right. And with something like this, I have to say that I mean, I wish them luck. I wish them all the best. But I don't think that it's going to be acceptable for the current labor force to go backwards. We don't go backwards. People never go backwards. Sometimes we go forward very determinedly in the wrong direction and have to course correct. But we always go forwards.
This is true. What do you feel, since I know you're by birth American, but you're living in the European Union, how do you feel that the approach is different specifically to co-working around these issues in the different areas?
In the United States, we have the ADA. The ADA happened when I was in school, so I'm that old. So it was a very, I mean, I was in school, so it was actually very confrontational, the ADA. There was a lot of screaming. There was a lot of hollering about, you know, how much it was costing and this is all impossible and it's always been impossible and blah, blah. And it turned out it's really possible if you have a determined will to do it. So that revolution has not occurred in Europe or the United Kingdom. Definitely has not. The Netherlands adopted the UN, and now I'm in a language problem. The Dutch word is verdrag. I'm going to have to look it up.
Well, while you're doing that, let me just explain to our listeners that the ADA is the American Disabilities Act, which protects the ability of people with disabilities to exist, basically, in this society.
Right.
It tries to, anyway.
Right. And part of I'm trained as a lawyer. I was a practicing lawyer in Atlanta from 1993, and part of my practice was education law, which is the law of essentially building and guaranteeing the rights of students at schools through individual education programs and accommodations and all of that stuff. So that I was very much aware of. I used to teach at a law school in Atlanta the subject of education law, and actually one of my students wrote a book about it and dedicated it to me. It was like the honor of my life. I was so touched. He didn't tell me. Somebody else showed me. He never told me. They just said, look, this book is dedicated to you. I was like, oh, wow.
That's amazing. Wow.
That was a feeling, really. So the Netherlands, where I live, only just adopted the UN agreement on the human rights of people with disabilities like 3 years ago. And they haven't enacted it yet. And I mean, Europe has not got a legal structure. There is not a will to, as the ADA just said, you will do this now, right? There is still a conversation about it. Now, I will also say two things. One is, I live in a house in the Netherlands, and this house, what was built in the mid-1600s. And the first time that I slept in this house, I was not yet married. It was my future in-law's house. I looked at the ceiling and I thought the nails in that ceiling, some of the nails in that ceiling are, let me count, like 400 years older than my country. And that was a very weird feeling. So one of the things that Europe is dealing with is that, Emily, Amsterdam is not going to take down their canal houses.
Right.
They're definitely not, right? Like of accessibility course. Or no accessibility. And those things are not accessible. They are absolutely not. They were not built for accessibility. And they're really old. And they're not going to take them down. I am not. There's a lot of talk about this problem. That problem does not disturb me that much because, Emily, they have some of the best designers in the world in this country. If they have the will to fix that problem, they can fix that problem. I am sure of it. How? I don't know, because I'm not a designer. But I have seen some really remarkable solutions applied in various places in Europe. So that is a thing that has to be taken into account, that in all of the capitals of Europe, much of the architecture is going to be a serious challenge to get it accessible. And the answer is not then, so we won't do it, right? The answer is how do we do it? But it is, everybody needs to acknowledge that it's a serious problem. It is a serious problem. The pipes go where the pipes go, right? The foundation is where the foundation is. And the choice, which was made often in the United States, then take it down because it has to be accessible to everyone, is simply not going to happen in Europe. In the United States, it's different. You want to take down a building that's 40 years old? Okay, no problem. Right.
So, of course, yeah. There are a few buildings that are much older than that, honestly.
Well, yes, I understand. But but really, I mean, the Netherlands isn't even that old. Go to Prague. If you go walk around Prague for a while, everything in the Netherlands looks like it was built yesterday. I mean, it's incredible. I mean, the ancientness of that is just astonishing. But that aside, it is an issue, needs to be addressed. It will be addressed. They have great designers. They have great architects. And if there's the will to solve this problem, they can solve this problem. The other thing about Europe, the United States doesn't have what Europe calls a social safety net at all. Like, when I moved here as an American, I was like, yes, we have a social safety net. We definitely do. we do. But compared to what, to the way they look at it here, for example, in the Netherlands, we have nothing. It's embarrassing, right? So the part of the issue that comes with that, if you look at it carefully, so here's the thing. If you're disabled in the Netherlands, you go to typically, they've only just started integrating children with disabilities into regular classrooms. When I moved here, the children with disabilities went to different schools. And so they had special schools and they had special diplomas. And when they get out, they have special jobs and they have special apartments. And they have, I mean, it's just everything. So once you're in that track, you're in that track. And in fairness, your life will be good. But it won't be everybody else's life. And one of the conversations I have had a lot with Europeans is, and I'm not finished deciding, to tell you the truth, those systems are extremely different. In the United States, we have a lot more. We have people with Down syndrome graduating from college with a bachelor's degree. We have people with significant disabilities who are lawyers. They are doctors. They are researchers, right? We have a lot more of that in the United States than there is in, well, the Netherlands, certainly. Europe generally, I would say probably also, although Spain is doing a lot of good work. But the question becomes, from a moral perspective, what's better, right? And it's not
is there a happy medium too? Is there a way to bring all that together?
I hope so. I think that they're working on it now. Children with disabilities in the Netherlands still are now being integrated into they started about 20-ish years ago, are being integrated into regular classrooms with what we would call accommodations. They don't call them accommodations. They call them something else, but same thing. Mm-hmm. And the boundaries of who has to go to a lot of parents want their children to go to schools for kids because they're not just, this is the special needs school. They have a school near here for children who are deaf, hard of hearing, or have language disorders, communication disorders. All of those are in the same school because communication problems, whether they are caused by the fact that you are deaf or whether they are caused by the fact that your brain processes sound differently, are nevertheless communication problems. So from their perspective, the cause is not the point. right? The education is the point. And a lot of parents prefer for their children to go to schools that are specifically focused on the disability that their child has. There's also an argument to be made that those children are not, when you're in a whole school full of people who have a disability of the same nature as the one you have, you feel way less weird.
Yeah.
The point often made. So there's a whole conversation around all of this to be had. And I mean, we will come out. People always come out. So I'm not worried about that. But the awareness of your average guy on the street about issues of accessibility, at least in the Netherlands where I am, but I mean, my sense is over most of Europe, is not actually that great, because they are accustomed, they have been accustomed for some generations to these parallel tracks.
Right. Well, it's a lot to think about and a lot to piece together. There are certainly many sides and many factors that come into it that we're going to have to work on as a society, and hopefully it will bring us together more and not push us further apart. That's not the way we want the trend to go, is it?
No, that's true. I mean, one of the things about being part of the transition in the United States is the attitude towards people with disabilities changed very much from the time that I was first in, say, early grammar to middle school, and the time that I graduated from high school. Some of the benefit of integrated classrooms is that those children become adults. It's the weirdest thing. And when those children become adults, they already have experience with people with disabilities on a daily basis.
Right. Maybe it's just good. Normal. They're just right. People that they live alongside, you know.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. Yeah, because people with disabilities don't necessarily want special treatment. They just want equal treatment to be able to access the same things and be able to get the same kind of education that anybody else does.
Yes, and the part about it that's very frustrating is that sometimes that's hard. In some cases, it's hard. Some people have complex issues. In the majority, I would say, certainly during my practice, majority of cases that I ran into, listen, the only ones I got into were the ones where somebody hired a lawyer, so they were pretty hot, right? And because people don't just trot out and hire lawyers. So most of them, the accommodations that were being requested, you know, they're not that expensive and they're not that hard. It's just different. I mean, there are three kinds of, in my opinion, there are three kinds of institutions in the world, right? There are the ones that build, there are the ones that destroy, and there are the ones that are stabilizing. And schools are stabilizing. They have always been stabilizing. They serve a stabilizing function in society. That's what they do. And so they hate change. and they fight change every chance they get. And change is work. Even if the result is that there's less work. You have to get through the stage where you're learning about the change, right? It's like when you, as an entrepreneur, if I hire somebody because I have too much work, the problem is the minute I hire them, I have twice as much work as I had before because I have to train them to do the work.
Right.
And then when they're
trained. You have to supervise the work. You have to, you know, look over the shoulder, make sure that quality control is happening appropriately. Absolutely.
Right. And then once they're trained, you can go, hooray, and then you don't have so much work. But the initial phase, that's why I have learned hard experience here, start hiring before you need somebody. Because by the time you need them, you're going to have to train them, and then you're really not going to be getting any sleep. So, And that's, I think, you know, with most change processes, I think that's true. So it is a different perspective about disability in Europe, and yet it is simultaneously more accepting and also more categorical. Like, I think the American effort is to say we're all the same, and at least the Dutch, and I assume, you know, Europe is a big place. say we're all equal before the law. We all have equal rights to education, jobs, whatever, but we're not the same. And they really focus on that. And it's a touch off-putting when you first get here, and then you get used to it and realize they're just very practical. And it is true that, there are some things that there are some differences that are irreducible.
Absolutely. Yeah.
The top third of the storage, I mean, this is a very trivial example. Top third of the storage available in my home will never be used by me.
Right. Right. Oh my gosh, me too.
Right, because I am not 5 feet tall. In European, I am not 150 centimeters tall. And so, listen, the top shelves, y'all, you can put my Christmas present up there on the top shelf and I'll never see it.
Well, this has been a wonderful conversation, and I appreciate you joining us for this, Janine. Thank you so much, everyone, for listening to this episode of the Accessibility Edition of the Coworking Values Podcast. I am Emily Breeder, and we've been talking to Janine van der Linden. Janine, if someone wanted to reach you, would they go to the European Coworking Assembly website and send you a message there?
Your fastest way to reach me, if you don't have my contact information, is in fact to go to coworkingassembly.eu and fill in any of the contact forms, because those all come to me. You can also contact me through our social media, the social media of the European Coworking Assembly, or any of our projects, the Rural Coworking Project, the Inclusion Project, we have a whole list of them. Those contacts go to a different person, but they will get to me. Fastest way is just fill in the contact form and tell me what you're thinking about, because it's all gone.
Wonderful. So if you'll be in London the last week of February 2024, consider attending the Workspace Design Show on February 27th and 28th. The London Coworking Assembly Breakfast Show will be held on both mornings of that event. So for details, please join the London Coworking Assembly mailing list on londoncoworkingassembly.com. Thank you so much, Janine, and I'll talk to you again another time.
Okay, later.
Bye.